Eve Day, cloudy, slight chance of rain, high of 52. Monday, Christmas Day, looks to be very rainy, with cloudy skies, perhaps an 80% chance of rain, and a high right around 50 degrees. The time is 10 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to WGTDHD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. The morning show is next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll spend most of the hour talking about the great game of basketball through the lens of fashion. Here's part one. Well, I'm very intrigued by the book that I hold in hand called Fly, the Big Book of Basketball Fashion. Yes, this is a book about professional basketball and about the striking fashion statements that have been made by many of basketball's greatest legends down through the years. It's a really intriguing idea and executed really, really beautifully by my morning show guest, Mitchell S. Jackson. He's actually a winner of the 2021 Pulitzer Prize in Feature Writing and the 2021 National Magazine Award in Feature Writing. And perhaps you've heard of his book, The Residue Years, as well as Survival Math and the forthcoming John of Watts. And he is obviously someone who is sought after. His work appears in many places, including New York Times Magazine, Esquire, and in many, many other places. And he is the John O. Whiteman Dean's Distinguished Professor in the Department of English at Arizona State University. And he is behind this intriguing book that takes us through, in a sense, the history of the NBA through its fashion. And it's something that, of course, a lot of us are aware of, but perhaps have not deeply thought about. And we'll find out from Mitchell Jackson just why this was intriguing enough to him that he wanted to explore it to this length with this really wonderful book published by Artisan. Again, titled Fly, the Big Book of Basketball Fashion. And Mitchell S. Jackson, or I guess I should say Professor Mitchell S. Jackson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Let's first find out from you your own relationship to the sport of basketball. Is basketball something you played or mostly watched? And at what point did this other facet of basketball, and especially professional basketball, become of such interest to you?
Yeah, basketball. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. And one of the things we call Portland, Oregon is Rip City. So I was a kid when those really good Blazer teams with Clyde Drexler and Terry Porter and Jerome Kersey and Kevin Duckworth and Buck Williams were, you know, winning conference finals. They went and played the Bulls that year. And then some of my high school friends and some of the guys I looked up to in high school, they actually went to the NBA. So we had a guy, Damon Stoudemire, who's a really good friend, who ended up winning Rookie of the Year. And so Portland is a really big basketball city, and I played basketball in high school in through junior college. And I also, from the time that I was a child, had a fascination with fashion. I would read a bunch of Esquire and GQ magazines, or really not read them, but look at the pictures when I was young. And so I had those two things really from a very young age. And, you know, all these years later, I've been writing about basketball for quite a number of years, my first piece of published writing was a feature story about basketball players. And so I noticed, you know, recently that how much emphasis the NBA and other sports leagues have been putting on the players' fashion. And I think the NBA is really the forerunner in fashion and professional sports. And I thought, well, now is a good time to put my, you know, twin passions to work and really investigate the history of NBA fashion and how we got to this place right now.
Hmm. In an early chapter in the book titled Influence, you tell us about, I think really help us kind of appreciate the singular position of professional basketball, and especially the singular position and influence of basketball's biggest stars, that is, the NBA's biggest stars. I think we don't often maybe stop to think about that in relationship to perhaps popular baseball players or popular football players.
Yeah.
There really is something else going on when it comes to the leading stars of the NBA. What exactly is that difference or distinction in your mind?
I want to give you an anecdote that I think really spells out the point that you're asking or the question you're asking. I just attended the NBA play-in tournament in Las Vegas. And while I was leaving, going through TSA, there was a guy that walked up behind me, and I kind of glanced at him, and I said, wow, that guy really looks like Barry Bonds. And then I looked back again, I'm like, nah, that's probably Barry Bonds. So I watched, and we were both going through clear, so I saw his name pop up on the screen to get verified through clear, and it was, in fact, Barry Bonds. And so the whole way through, it was a long line. He took his shoes off and his backpack and everything else like everyone else. And then he came through, and not a single person said, hey, sir, can I have your autograph? Hey, can I take a picture with you? I mean, granted, we were in TSA. And then I was like thinking when I got through, Barry Bonds is not even arguably one of the greatest baseball players that's ever lived, right? And imagine a comparable NBA player. Like, imagine Michael Jordan coming through a TSA line in Las Vegas. Like, it just, he would be mobbed. And I thought, man, that's how that must, I mean, maybe Barry likes that, but I just think that the NBA has done such a great job in marketing their players and making them bigger than life and making them people that are recognized off the court, that the other major sports leagues are really lagging in those areas. And so I think the marketing prowess of the NBA and the foresight to allow their players to become really businesses unto themselves is responsible for that.
Hmm. I really love a moment I think that speaks to this in a section of the book called Style Matters, in which you tell a story about the legendary LeBron James getting off of an airplane wearing something that, you know, in a sense, turned the world on its ear. I think it was for on his way to the or way back from the Beijing Olympics. Tell our listeners about this.
Yeah, so that was Beats by Dre headphones, which were new, and they were actually a headphone that was, well, they were super expensive and still are, and they were being marketed to people who worked in music studios, so like professional equipment, but somehow the people who made them got them to LeBron, and they wore them in off of the plane in Beijing, and it was one of the first viral moments connected to an NBA player, and the Beats by Dre headphones just started selling and selling and selling. And I think it was a time when Madison Avenue recognized that NBA players could sell us things that were not connected to basketball. You know, before, yeah, they were giving us Gatorade, and, you know, and they had sneakers and workout apparel, but to sell us headphones, that was unusual. And I think that moment really kind of showed the impact that NBA players had outside of their sphere.
Hmm. I'm glad that rather early in the book you make what I think is a central point, And this is also maybe a way in which these superstar NBA players are very much a different matter versus their counterparts in football or baseball. And that is the way in which so many of these NBA superstars are redefining the whole notion of masculinity and of what fashion can say about, for instance, an elite athlete. And I don't think I took your book in hand and saw all these photographs that I really stopped to think about the way in which some really dramatic, bold statements have been made with the fashion choices of some of these superstars. What are your thoughts about this whole notion of masculinity and fashion choices and what's going on with the fashion choices that some of these players are choosing and or adopting?
Yeah, I mentioned Dennis Rodman there, who's before his time in terms of kind of gender bending or challenging rigid notions of gender through his fashion. I think the distinction between what Rodman was doing in the 1990s and what these young men are doing in the 2020s is that Rodman seemed to want to shock us in what he was doing, like he was in it for the attention. And I think these young men are actually part of the LGBTQI movement, whether or not they would realize that or even say it, because we're living in an era where gender is being redefined, and it's not just them. You know, if you look at a lot of the high fashion brands, you go to their sites, and now there's androgyny. There's some sites don't even list whether something is for a man or a woman anymore. And so this idea of unisex or androgynous or non-gender clothing is part of the movement, I think, the trans movement, clearly. And I think that these young people are growing up with a different set of ideas about the world and ideas about sexuality and ideas about gender, and they're using fashion to display these evolving notions. And so now you have young men who probably would consider themselves hetero wearing fingernail paint and, wearing skirts now. And so, I think we're just in a different era. I mean, it's harder for me to can't see myself wearing a skirt at now 48 years old, but for a young 28, 21-year-old guy who's really trying to push against these rigid notions of gender, that's the thing he can do.
I don't think we should go any farther without talking about the matter of race and the fact that when we look through your book, although once in a while we'll see the face of Larry Bird or Kevin Love, by and large, the vast majority of players that we are seeing in this book and the vast majority of the players that you're really talking about in terms of bold fashion statements are players of color. How much is this tied up in that? And do you see the bold and often flamboyant fashion choices being made by some of these superstars as being tied up in matters of racial identity?
Absolutely. I think a lot of different things connected to racial identity. One is the notion of oppression and how you resist that oppression. And one way is for you to be, black people have obviously been financially and socially oppressed. And one way to resist that is to dress flamboyantly, is to show your wealth, is to aspire to be something other than what, the society has kind of created for you. So I think there's that, like there's a showing of your wealth or imagining that you could be this through your clothing. I also think culturally, if you think about Africans, they're generally more ostentatious and vibrant, right? Like think about all the cloth that you can think of that's African cloth, how vibrant the patterns are, how many colors they have in it. And then if you go back and look at old kings and queens and tribal leaders, how much jewelry they would have used to adorn themselves in. I also feel like, you know, most recently hip-hop has taken on that, right? Like, if you want to know what black ostentatiousness is, look at hip-hop. And so these young men now are really connected, or they're the same people as the rappers, right? They come out of the same neighborhood, they're around the same age, they have some of the same social limitations, and they're using their talents to ascend beyond those restrictions. And, you know, the league has for a long time been a black league, but we should mention that when it started in 1946, there were no black players. They didn't get a black player until 1950. The first three black players came into the NBA. So in the beginning of the league, there's a lot more parity, there's a lot more uniformity in what the players are wearing. But once the black guys got in there and got a little bit of power, they started wearing their bell bottoms and their afros and their butterfly collars and their two chains.
We're speaking with Mitchell S. Jackson about his book, Fly, The Big Book of Basketball Fashion. We should say that the book is laid out according to eras. And so we have the conformists early on versus flamboyance, Jordan. We all know what that means. The Iverson effect, dress code, and insta-tunnel walk. So different eras, not just strict decades or whatever. How hard was it for you to kind of come up with this framework for the book and for you to, in a sense, define the history of NBA fashion in this way? I mean, did these eras easily and sort of obviously come to mind, or did it take some work to kind of sort that out?
I should say that in the beginning, I was actually going to do it by decades, and luckily I had an editor who suggested that decades would be kind of arbitrary. They wouldn't necessarily mark shifts in significant shifts in the fashion. And once he said that to me, I really started to try to investigate a lot of photos, right? Look at a lot of photos so I could see where there are noticeable shifts. And that took a lot of time. I mean, this book took almost 3 years to write, and I thought it was going to be a few months project. But once I got into it, and especially once I got to the 1970s, which is about when I started, you know, early 1980s is when I started watching basketball. So I had a little bit more lived experience in terms of what players I should be looking for and what was happening in the league. But certainly those earlier ones, the flamboyance in the uniformity in the first era, that was harder. And it was also less pictures to look at, right? Like, there ain't that many pictures of George Mike in street clothes. but I enjoyed it because while I was doing this book, I was also becoming kind of a basketball historian, which I had never done. And I played basketball for 20 years.
One thing that I especially appreciated about the book is in the chapter devoted to the great Michael Jordan and his era, yeah, which you define as from the early 1980s to the late 1990s. So it's a long period, yeah, in which his influence is felt. That your book goes way beyond just the Air Jordans, which are what we immediately think of, yeah, in terms of Michael Jordan and fashion. But there were also things like his signature baggy basketball shorts. And I never really knew, yeah, the full story behind that. I mean, behind that choice and then how yeah, that became, you know, kind of the way to go after that. Explain to our listeners or remind our listeners about that.
Yeah, Jordan, I mean, I think the thing to say about Michael Jordan is at his apex, he was the most famous person in the world. There was a poll taken, and Jordan was second only to Jesus in fame in the world. And so if you got a person that famous, whether people like what they're doing or not, they're going to have influence. And so Jordan had a tremendous amount of impact and influence on the NBA, certainly, and then at large. And or writ large. And I think the shorts came out of him really having a fidelity to North Carolina. He would wear his North Carolina shorts under his Bulls shorts and therefore they had to be baggier, which is strange because it would give you more weight, right? So it also makes it kind of harder to do what you can do. But apparently it didn't matter because Mike was still flying around the court. And I think we also can't separate that time that Mike is wearing the baggy shorts from what's happening in college basketball at the time, which is the Michigan Big Five or the Fab Five, who notoriously, maybe not notoriously, who famously wear their shirts really, really, really large and were the most famous college basketball team in that year that they were together. So I think those two things really pushed the culture towards the baggy look. And also, if you look at the eras, to me, one era is always resisting what was popular in a previous era and trying to reimagine it. And so if you look at what came right before Jordan, you're looking at those really short, short NBA shorts. And so for Jordan to make a mark, he had to move away from that. If you look a few years ago, the NBA had kind of moved back towards the short shorts because the long shorts had been in vogue for so long. So I think it always, I mean, we always kind of look back at what has happened and then try to reimagine how to move forward.
Right. And I know we don't have much time left. I want to talk briefly about the really interesting chapter that follows your chapter on Michael Jordan, which you call the Iverson Effect, with Allen Iverson. And this is kind of the hip-hop era of NBA. You call it Allen Iverson a paragon of hip-hop splendiferousness. but what's really interesting is that one of the things that emerges in the wake of that is a dress code instituted in 2005 by NBA Commissioner David Stern. Remind our listeners about that. Yeah. And its significance and the interesting way in which this dress code was crafted.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, you know, one era is constantly defining itself on the previous era. And so if you think about Allen Iverson, he came in on the heels of Jordan. So Jordan still ruled really when Iverson came in. And so two important points. One, how do you define yourself against what's before you? So Iverson had to be different than Jordan. The other thing is Iverson and I are the same age, born in 1975, which is around the inception of hip-hop. So Iverson, as a child, doesn't know an America without hip-hop. Jordan and Charles Barkley and those guys, they did. And so Iverson is part of the first era of NBA players who always knew hip hop. And I think that showed in the ethos of hip hop, right? And it being a counterculture movement and being these impoverished people in the Bronx trying to figure out how they could resist their oppression. And I think that ethos spanned Iverson's whole career. I also feel like Iverson was mythologized before he ever even got to the league. He had a brawl when he was in high school. He was actually sent to jail. He had to get a prison pardon or governor's pardon. And then he goes to Georgetown and plays for the most famous black basketball coach probably in the history of college basketball, in John Thompson. And then he was the number one pick. So by the time Iverson gets to the league, he's already a myth. And then he has, you know, obviously he does well. He's rookie of the year. He plays very well. I think all of those things really help Iverson have maybe even an outsized influence. But Iverson, to me, represents the generation that takes over the NBA that is also hip-hop.
Hmm. I want to mention that the book is spectacular to look at in terms of the photographs. And there are also several different interviews that are also part of this, in which you talk with very specific figures who are kind of part of this world, including designers. I bet that was a special pleasure for you.
Yes, it was. I like talking to PJ Tucker, too, because he's like the sneaker god of the NBA. But I think something that's interesting about the NBA and their fashion is how it's spawned these cottage industries, right? So now you have stylists and jewelers, and now there are people trying to get, you know, marketing opportunities. And so to me, that lets you know how big it is. I mean, just at the play-in tournament, the NBA itself made a red carpet and a special tunnel for the players to come in through. So it's certainly a huge aspect now of the NBA.
Hmm. Last quick question. Did your faculty colleagues give you any any I don't know. Let me rephrase
they
that.
Liked it.
They didn't sort of look at you with wonderment that you would devote so much time and energy to a topic like this?
Well, they didn't know that I was doing it until it came out.
Ah.
So that's one thing. And I feel like I do so much other work in between. Like I write a column for Esquire. I'm a contributor at the New York Times Magazine. So I have enough other things going that I think it'd be really hard to dismiss me as an unserious academic with my other work. But I'm sure there were some that didn't say anything to me that were kind of looking down their noses at my project.
Well, it's actually a terrific book. And although I came to this not with any sort of natural interest in it in place at all, I really loved this book and I learned a whole lot about it. And I can certainly imagine a basketball fan, and especially someone who is a fan of many of these great players, really enjoying this book thoroughly. Again, it's titled Fly, The Big Book of Basketball Fashion, and its author, Mitchell S. Jackson. Professor Jackson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about your really entertaining and interesting book. Thank you so much and best wishes.
Thank you. I had a great time.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part two of today's program, which once again deals with the world of professional basketball through, in a sense, the lens of fashion. We have a real treat for any basketball fans that might be listening. We have before us today a really interesting book about basketball, and beyond basketball, also a book about some of the most iconic basketball shoes or sneakers that have emerged over the years. The story told in a great book called A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers. And the author of this book is Russ Bengston, who has written extensively for many, 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 many years on the sneaker, and has made contributions to all kinds of different publications, and has talked with many, many insiders of the sport to put together this book that not only talks about the history of basketball, but the history of, in a sense, the evolution of the sneaker, which in so many ways is two stories beautifully intertwined. And it's a book that's beautiful to look at, really nicely put together. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with its author, Russ Bengston, for the next few minutes about A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers. Russ Bengston, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. I really appreciate it and really appreciate the introduction.
Yeah, and it's a really nicely put together book. So help us understand what came first, or is it impossible to say that first you became interested in sneakers and then became interested in the game of basketball itself? I mean, what exactly is your relationship here and the history of that?
Well, I mean, I talk about it a little bit in the introduction, and, you know, part of the reason I ended up writing the book is because I couldn't untangle myself which one I got into first. You know, I was kind of in the prime age. I remember, you know, the first Air Jordan came out when I turned 14. I very badly wanted that shoe, you know, and I became a Michael Jordan fan, and I was trying to figure out, like, okay, which one actually did come first? You know, I must have seen some of that Jordan Carolina game when he won the, you know, NCAA championship in 1982. But a lot of my primary memories of him were in the NBA. So, you know, part of the reason the whole idea of the book came together was because these two stories have been one for me, you know, almost my entire life.
And as you say very well, there's almost no point in trying to untangle or I mean, those two storylines, the story of basketball and the story of basketball shoes, it makes no sense to even try to separate them. So in your book, you're actually exploring them in concord with each other, and it really works great. You also say at one point that in some respects, this book is a culmination of your whole life and all that you have explored and researched and studied and celebrated and collected over these many, many years. Just give our listeners some sense of how the basketball shoe has, in a sense, kind of enveloped your whole life.
Yeah, I mean, I started working for Slam magazine in the mid-90s, and one of the reasons I actually wanted to work for them, I saw the first issue they did browsing a newsstand in a supermarket, and, you know, they had a separate sneaker section in the back, and that was something you wouldn't have seen in Sport or Sports Illustrated or the Sporting News, whoever else existed at the time. And the idea that not only was there a magazine dedicated just to basketball, which was already my favorite sport at that point, but actually covered the sneakers separately aside from it, you know, that was something I absolutely wanted to do. And then once I got to Slam, I ended up taking it, well, probably not taking it on myself. I'm sure it was put upon me at first, but, you know, taking it upon myself later to expand that sneaker coverage and try and do more, because I knew players were getting stuff that players were getting stuff you wouldn't see in stores. So it was convincing companies, look, send us a pair of those so we can shoot them and show them. You know, I don't think the companies then even realized what they had and how obsessed some people really were with, like, you know, watching whether it was Michael Jordan or Penny Hardaway or Shaquille O'Neal or whoever it was, and saying, like, wait a minute, that shoe they're wearing is slightly different than the one I can go buy. And people actually wanted to see that stuff. So, you know, I think this was, and the idea behind the book even was, you know, this is something people have been fascinated with for decades. And while I feel like obviously there have been great books about basketball, there have been great books about sneakers, there haven't been as many that kind of tried to tell it as one story.
Right, and I think you've done a great job of doing that, and it's a wonderful idea. How hard was it to come up with the 15 iconic sneakers that you explore in detail? Or did that list come together pretty easily and without too much pain or discomfort?
It started easy, and then it got rapidly more difficult. You know, this was a case where, like, you know, the idea came first, and then the title was really fast. It was like, oh, man, this is how I want to package this. And, you know, initially I was thinking more a history of basketball in 10 sneakers, and I think maybe I thought about 12. And when I started putting the list together, you know, it starts out easy. I mean, obviously the Chuck Taylor takes up so much of the early history, and then Adidas with the Superstar and the Air Force One, the Air Jordan. And once you get past that Air Jordan One in 1985, like, the basketball sneaker industry specifically just exploded. And there were so many brands and so many shoes and so many players. And I realized pretty quickly that 10 was not going to get it done. You know, I would miss like a decade and a half, or I would have two that covered roughly the same time frame. So I had to open it up a little bit, and I didn't want to get too crazy. You know, it's like you could have done 20 or 25, you know, pretty easily, but then you're talking about super short chapters and probably really like glossing over things. So, you know, 15 was kind of that compromise sweet spot where it's like I can go a little more in depth with things and not feel like, oh my God, I'm missing, you know, this entire period.
Explain to our listeners, particularly for those that don't follow this all that closely, that when a given player's name is, in a sense, emblazoned on a sneaker or that is its name. I mean, a player like Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant or whoever. Explain the connection that there has been and the range of involvement in terms of the shaping, the crafting, the creation of that given sneaker. I mean, for instance, how much did Michael Jordan have to do with the specific design of the first Air Jordan, or did it simply bear his name? And I think what I gather from your book is that the answer to that question is complicated, and it kind of depends on which player we're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely depends. And, you know, to use Michael Jordan as that example, when the first Air Jordan came about, you know, a lot of it was mostly talking to him about, like, okay, what are you going to be comfortable playing in? And, you know, the Air Force One was Nike's big air basketball shoe at the time, and, like, it was really high, and the sole was really thick, and you're kind of high off the ground, and Jordan wanted something lower that he could sort of have a better feel in, and that led to them using a really small airbag in it. Like, that was his primary addition to that conversation. You know, later on, I think with a lot of Air Jordans, you had Tinker Hatfield become the designer, starting with the three, and his idea was to pull things out of Jordan's life to use in a shoe. So he would, like, go to Jordan's house or talk to Jordan about, like, what was the last car you bought? You know, what are you into right now? And, like, use some of those insights to build a shoe. But then when you get as far as Kobe, and Kobe's was kind of an outlier, where he was very, very, very specific and very, very, very involved in nearly every step of the way, and, like, had very specific requests as far as both performance and appearance in these shoes. Like, you know, if you bought a Kobe shoe, especially later in his career with Nike, like, you knew you were getting something that he had a say in every aspect of.
Mm. I'm so glad that your book has such a long historic view, and that, for instance, the first chapter of your book really takes us essentially back to the birth of basketball back in the late 19th century with Dr. James Naismith and the emergence of what now we sort of think of as the first iconic basketball sneaker, the Converse Chuck Taylor All-Star. And there, right on the first page is this huge color photograph of one of these great shoes. It's just amazing to look at this and to think about where this industry will go in subsequent decades. I mean, it's like a Model T and a Ferrari or something. I mean,
yeah.
It really gives us a sense of the dramatic sweep that we are talking about. But I can tell that you are a student of history and you love exploring and remembering and sharing with us the early days of the sport and this very first of the great basketball sneakers.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the Chuck in particular, you know, it's obviously such a ubiquitous shoe. I mean, it feels like everyone either has or has had a pair of Chuck Taylors at some point in their life. And, you know, I felt like it was important just to talk about how it was a performance shoe. You know, I mean, you look at it now as kind of archaic and almost funny, but, you know, back then it was the shoe that everyone wanted. I mean, even when other brands started to sprout up and make their own similar canvas shoes. You know, Converse was valued as that sort of originator of, you know, what that design was. And it's sort of, it's impressive that it stood for that long.
Right.
You know, until Adidas in the 60s built the first leather, you know, the first different leather basketball shoe. Converse had played with leather with the Chuck Taylor, but it was still essentially the same shoe.
I was, as I read your book, was surprised to see how long it remained, you know, kind of a major contender. And we see wonderful photographs of some great basketball players in the relatively recent past wearing this iconic shoe. I know that you have, you know, special affection for several of the shoes that you talk about, and one of them being the Air Force Max. Just tell us real quick why this especially grabbed your attention.
Yeah, I mean, the Air Force Max was a shoe that Nike introduced in the early 90s, and the thing that stood out for me was it was designed as a shoe for Charles Barkley, who at that point was, you know, had gone from Philadelphia to Phoenix, become an MVP, was obviously like an iconoclast in his own right. I don't know if I would go so far as to say the anti-Jordan, but, you know, certainly different from Michael Jordan. But then was also adopted by the Fab Five, the Michigan class of freshmen in 1992-1993, who made it to two straight title games and kind of flipped college basketball on its head. And, you know, the idea that a shoe like that could have these two sort of entirely separate basketball lives, you know, one intended and one that sort of was adopted, you know, I think that really stood in for a lot of what sneakers have become now. You know, I think prior to that, you had a lot of stuff that was created for a specific purpose, used for that purpose, primarily known for that purpose. And the Fab Five really, you know, flipped things around. They were consumers as much as they were sort of signature level athletes. And they co-signed on this shoe, which, you know, really made it even more important than it was.
Well, that and other really interesting stories are told so well in your great book, A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers, a wonderful gift for anybody who is a fan of the game and fascinated with the long and rich history of the sneaker. This is published by Workman Publishing, the author Russ Bengston. Russ Bengston, congrats on a wonderful book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thanks so much, Greg. Anytime.
And John Feinstein now talks about a book published a couple of years ago for young adults called Game Changers, part of his Benchwarmers series, following the exploits of two talented and good-hearted young athletes, Andy Carrillo and Jeff Michaels. Explain a little more about the two main characters who we would first meet in Benchwarmers and who we get to know even better in Game Changers.
Yeah, sure. Andrea, who goes by Andy, and Jeff are the two main characters. They're sixth graders, as I think you mentioned earlier. In Benchwarmers, the middle school where they both go does not have a girls' soccer team. It has a girls' field hockey team. Andy is a very good soccer player, and she wants to try out for the boys' team because she thinks she's good enough to make it. And, in fact, she is. But there's a misogynist coach who doesn't think girls should be on a boys' team, and so he cuts her, even though she's probably one of the three or four best players out there. And Jeff, whose dad works for a local TV station in Philadelphia, helps her get on the team by publicizing what the coach has been doing. And that's really where the plot evolves from, and the two of them become good friends, and Andy becomes a very important player on the team and has to win over not only the coach but some of her teammates. Not all of them, but some of them. And you wish in 2020 that sort of thing didn't exist, just as we wish in 2020 that racism didn't exist, but they do. And in this book, the second one, Game Changers, now it's basketball season. Jeff's on the boys' team, and Andy's on the girls' team. And the boys' team has, you know, squabbles that 11- and 12-year-olds will have. trying to figure out how to get along with one another and how to play as a team. I always try to, I don't want to preach in these books, Greg, but I try to put messages in there for the kids about what's right and what's wrong and about how you deal with things in sports and in life. The girls' team has a bigger problem. They have a coach who's a racist, who stereotypes the African-American kids on the team, and mostly out of ignorance. And the girls, as the season goes on, realize what's going on. And eventually they revolt. And that's where the plot kind of builds to a crescendo. And again, it gets back. I wrote this book long before George Floyd was murdered, because I've always thought that that race has been the elephant in the room in sports and in our society for years. I mean, just go back to Colin Kaepernick and go back to the national anthem protests of 2017 and the way so many white people reacted to them. And of course, we've seen it more now, sadly, in the last 6 months. But it gets back again to my belief that kids who are reading these books, middle schoolers, high schoolers, whomever they might be, they know what's going on in the world. And they can read this and go, yeah, that can happen in real life.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's very interesting about this book is that we so like the two main protagonists, Jeff and Andy. I mean, they're not only talented athletes, but they're just good kids. I mean, really,
right.
Just good, all-around, likable kids. And yet, they get in trouble. And I don't mean get in trouble in the sense of, you know, smoking behind the shed kind of trouble. But
right. But
they get in trouble because of what they're doing with the very, very best of intentions. And I think that is really an interesting idea, to have two good kids who nevertheless do not find the way easy, sometimes exactly because that they are good kids with principles and integrity, and sometimes the adults in their lives don't know what to make of that. Can you tell us more about just how ripe that kind of ground is for writing a novel?
First of all, I'm a big believer that there are often times when we can learn from our kids. I know I have throughout my life, or ever since I've had kids. But beyond that, as a reader, when I'm writing, I try to think, I think like the reader that I am, not just the writer. And if somebody has, if I see a movie or read a book and there's nobody to root for, I have trouble getting into it. I think you need somebody to root for. It can't just be all bad guys. And throughout all of these kids' books I've written now, 14 of them, I've tried to have protagonists that the reader wants to root for. But you're right, they do get in trouble. I would never compare myself to J.K. Rowling, because she's a genius. But in the Harry Potter books, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, who are all good kids, are constantly in trouble because they step out of the lines of behavior that are supposed to exist in order to try to find out who the bad guys are and how to stop the bad guys. Now, on a completely different level, that's what Jeff and Andy are doing in this book. Andy is the one who first stands up and says, this is wrong in terms of the way their coach is handling them. And Jeff is the one who tries to get the team to come together in spite of the fact that there are a couple of very good players that nobody really likes. And he tries to do the right things, and Andy tries to do the right things. And I think because of that, even though, as you said correctly, they do get in trouble, they're getting in trouble for trying to do the right things, for trying to make things better for the people around them.
Right. Sports writer John Feinstein talking about this book intended for young readers, titled Game Changers, part of a series called The Bench Warmers. This book was published back in 2020. It's a minute before 9 o'clock, and tomorrow on the morning show, our last newly recorded interviews of the year. First, Dr. Catherine McCarthy, co-author of Raising a Child Who Can, Simple Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Adaptability and Emotional Strength. Really one of the most interesting and entertaining books about parenting that I've read in a long, long time. And then we're also going to be telling you the story that is behind a major motion picture that's just been released called The Boys in the Boat, which tells the story of an astonishing upset victory by the Americans in the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games. The interview is actually about a documentary that told that very same story, an American Experience documentary called The Boys of 36. It will be the interview that I made with the producer and